Now, the Berlin Wall fell on the 9th of November 1989, 30 years ago today. From across the world, we watched as East Germans flooded into the long-forbidden West. We revelled in images of people dancing on the wall, in stories of loved ones reunited after 28 years. But the end of the 40-year regime marked the start of a complicated reunification process, one that arguably continues today. What's been the legacy of the fall of the Berlin Wall, really? Anna Funder is the acclaimed author of Stasiland and a long-time observer of East German politics. In an article for the Sydney Morning Herald, she's argued that 30 years on, the Berlin Wall still casts its shadow, and the so-called victors and losers from this epic change are really a bit of a stew. I'll let her explain. Anna, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Now, before we get into those complications, just let's go back. You were an exchange student at the Free University in West Berlin in 1987 to 88, I believe. If you had then raised the idea that the Berlin Wall might fall by the end of 89, what would people's reaction have been?
Oh, they would have laughed. They would have thought I was crazy, absolutely crazy. There was no sense at the beginning of 1988 that the wall would ever fall. It just was like one of those permanent things. And yet at the end of the following year, it came down. Yes. So it was a shock. I think it was a shock even to the regime, or perhaps especially to the regime itself.
Yet in June 1988, the German Democratic Republic, the GDR, which was the Eastern regime, it lost its Soviet backing and was no longer able to quash dissent. Is this really what marked the beginning of the end, would you say? And what I'm getting at is the dissent was bubbling there, was it?
The dissent was bubbling. So East Germany was probably the most oppressed and the most surveyed of the Eastern Bloc states. There was one Stasi agent or officer for every 6.5 people, Stasi agent, officer or informer. So it was much more thoroughly oppressed than, you know, under the Nazi regime. The Gestapo ratio was much, much higher, and in Russia as well. So dissent was harder to come by, but it was definitely there. And in 89, demonstrators started very bravely coming onto the streets from about March. Every Monday, the demonstrations began in Leipzig and then they spread to other cities. So that's March. Then June is the Tiananmen Square massacre. But also the message coming from Russia is, we will not be sending the tanks in like in 68 or 53. We're not going to help you. You're on your own. It meant that the people on the streets, in a sense, became braver and more people went onto the streets. But it doesn't mean that they were any less frightened, because it could have been that the Stasi and the military in East Germany took it into their own hands and decided to shoot. They didn't, but it's really one of the miracles of that time is that this was a peaceful revolution.
And in the end, the wall only fell because of a mistake. You know, in that official who was tasked with announcing the changes at a press conference, he didn't really follow his brief, did he? He announced that border changes would take effect immediately.
Yes.
He wasn't supposed to say that.
Yes. So you might remember that people were cutting barbed wire. They were sort of cutting, as it were, holes in the wall, in the border, on the Austrian-Hungarian border. And so people were seeping out that way before the Berlin Wall fell. But that's exactly right. The regime was having to hold press conferences, which was something, of course, new to it. And there were foreign journalists at this press conference. And you can actually see this on YouTube, the announcement that the border will be open. It's an official, a very kind of pugnacious-looking, conceited-looking fellow. I don't know what he was actually like. Called Schabowski. And a question comes from an Italian journalist, because Schabowski announces, well, we've changed the travel regulations so that people are going to be able to travel without applying for visas. Of course, this is code for applying for visas, as if that had ever happened, you know. And then the journalist says, well, when is this going to take effect from? And he kind of leans back, and he wasn't at the Politburo meeting. He's just the messenger. He turns over this piece of paper like there might be some clue on it. And then he just makes it up kind of creatively and says, as far as I know, effective immediately. And this was broadcast on the news. So at 9 o'clock at night that night, people just got into their cars and went on foot and went to the border and demanded to be let out visa-free. And you see this footage of the Stasi guards in their boxes, and they're just absolutely shocked, having no idea what to do. And one of the things that I found out when I was writing Stasiland was that they had no idea what to do. So one of their Stasi superiors just thought, what am I going to do? I'll be creative about it in this very Stasi-esque way. And he gave the order that the most importunate, so the most eager to leave, the guards were going to stamp their passes, so their identity documents, on the left-hand side, and that way they could be identified later on, and refused re-entry back home. Of course, it never happened, but that always struck me as a kind of vicious symbol of trying to exercise power that they were in that moment losing.
It is extraordinary, that, isn't it? Truly. And meantime, they'd been shredding files at the most extraordinary rate, hadn't they? 180 kilometres worth of documents, I think you said. And when the shredders broke, they were tearing them by hand.
Yes, yeah, so East Germany, as we know, was a command economy. There were queues for everything. They didn't make enough shredders to shred the amount of stolen biographies on their people that they had. And they didn't want to be burning files, because while the demonstrators were demonstrating, if suddenly behind the Stasi offices there were these plumes of smoke, it would have enraged them. So yes, they shredded till the shredders broke, and then they sent agents out undercover to West Berlin to get more shredders and smuggled them in, and continued. And when those all broke, the order came to rip by hand. And so they barricaded themselves into the 14 district offices and the ones in Berlin and started shredding by hand. And when you see, it's very hard to shred big piles of paper, but I've seen a lot of these shredded files, and the most important documents were shredded into tiny, tiny little bits, like as if someone were very angry doing it. And others, they got big wads of paper, you know, maybe like a centimetre thick, and they were pulling them apart. And now there are 16,000 sacks, these vast sacks, bigger than me or bigger than you, full of these documents that are still not pieced together.
Look, truly, it's almost unbelievable to hear this, isn't it, really?
It is. When you look at almost anything very closely, reality tends to outstrip credibility.
Yes. Now, parts of the East have done very well out of the billions of euros that flowed eastward as part of the reunification solidarity tax. Do you think the effects of change on the old East Germany have been unevenly felt?
It's a very interesting and complex question. If you look at it, East Germany was the only state in the Eastern Bloc that had a rich cousin or brother state benefactor to pump billions into it. All the others were left on their own to sort themselves out. In East Germany, there was this, in a sense, fantastic thing that happened where lots of money was pumped in and lots of Western expertise was pumped in. But that also led to East Germans feeling, and this feeling is also evident in the next generation of people, because we're now 30 years on, a little bit like the poor cousins. So while you are benefiting from this massive flow of money and expertise, you also feel slightly second class in what you thought was your own country. So there's then a resurgence in nationalism, perhaps. Nationalism because a kind of nation was in existence for 40 years, and people are left then feeling, as it were, stateless, although they're not, of course. They've become part of this united Germany. But in recent elections there, the AfD, this far-right party, has done very well, shockingly well, 25% in Thuringia, for instance. And I think it's harnessing this kind of amorphous sense of being not listened to, a bit like the Brexiteers or Trump voters, a kind of white patriarchal dispossession and loss of nationhood exerting itself in support for a racist, xenophobic, nationalistic party. So it's much more complicated than I'm portraying it, but I think that's sort of where we're at the moment.
I mean, some people have written, I noticed in the conversation, that familiar landscapes and fond reminiscences have been airbrushed out by people who were sort of eager to move on. You know, maybe that's contributed to this identity loss or this perception of an identity loss.
Yes. I think the impetus to move on existed from almost the minute the Berlin Wall came down. And what that meant that they were moving on from, as they discovered more and more what a horrendous dictatorship existed there, how riven the society was into the Communist Party and its Stasi secret police and everybody else. There was, at the same time as those revelations were coming to light, a sense we've got to all live together, because you might run into your neighbour who was spying on you or your Stasi interrogator in the supermarket or in the cafe. We don't want the blood to run on the streets. Let's all get along. It's really impossible to move on from something until you've really acknowledged what the victims went through. Mm-hmm. There was no Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Mm-hmm. So you referred to sort of the activist avant-garde in those demonstrations in 89. They came from among the ranks of people who were imprisoned as political prisoners, and those people have never really been recognised. So the impetus to move on happened really before recognition of the people who brought that democratic change about and what they suffered took place. So it's a really complex question. And to my way of thinking, after the Second World War, there was a similar impetus to move on and not look too closely at what had happened during the Holocaust. So these comparisons are not direct, and I'm not making it as if one regime was the same or as bad as the other. But I think there's a very interesting thing that happens after an extremely traumatic period in a nation's history. The impetus to move on means that there is also an impetus to forget or ignore the very immediate past and its victims and perpetrators. And I think that's what's happened.
Do you think there is a forgetting underway?
There's definitely a forgetting underway. You know, there's a movement at the moment to say, well, you know, the GDR, it wasn't all bad. Really, people had subsidised rent and public transport and there was full employment, which was actually not true. But, you know, we paid a certain price in political liberty, but still we've got happy memories of that time. Mm. So I think that's a very dangerous route to go down. It is to undervalue what the political activists did in trying to bring about change from what was essentially a very tyrannical dictatorship.
But dictatorships where, oddly enough, there were quite a lot of services available, like, say, childcare, termination services, which apparently the women availed themselves of a lot. So, I mean, this may be a little more contested than you're describing in a sense, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I think that there were some things like that that were definitely better. And when you look at the fall of the wall, so the demonstration on the 4th of November, the wall fell on the 9th of November. The demonstration on the 4th was a massive demonstration in East Berlin at which civil rights activists spoke, but also Marcus Wolf, who was the head of the external spy service, spoke. People were not calling for an end to the country. People were calling to reform their own country. And yet, as soon as the wall fell 5 days later, all of the talk was about reunification. So along with reunification came losses of certain kinds.
Oh, that's very interesting. So do you think they actually were looking more for reform than for reunification?
Many people wanted reform. And the movement for reunification kind of
swept over
the
time.
It was like a tidal wave over everybody. Yes, yes. So,
see, Angela Merkel has been advancing the idea of late that actually young East young Germans who are from the East were looking for more explanations about what had happened to their parents, just like around about 68, West Germans were asking through the Bader-Meinhof and so on for explanations about what their families did in the war. So this is very deep, isn't it?
Look, it is very deep, and that goes back to what I was saying about this period of willful forgetting or ignoring immediately after a dictatorship ends. I didn't know that Angela Merkel was saying that, but I do know that in schools, for instance, what happened in that dictatorship isn't very much addressed at the moment. So maybe it will be. Marianne Bertler, who's the former head of the Stasi file authority, says, well, it was a 40-year dictatorship. Well, maybe we need 40 years to deal with it. But what's happening now is that the Stasi files are being put into the Federal Archive, so they're going to be more difficult for people to access. And at the end of this year, the law for compensation is set to expire for the former victims. So the signs are very disparate about ways of remembering and honouring the activists.
Anna Funder's my guest, who wrote that marvellous book, Stasiland, among others, and we're talking about the fall of the wall. It is interesting that more people from East Germany, let's call it that, now identify as Easterners before Germans, more than at the time of the wall falling.
I think, you know, it's particularly for the young people, they have no direct experience of what it's like to live behind a wall and not to be able to get out or what it's like to be denied university entrance for reasons that you will never know, or what it's like to have somebody in your family disappear into custody. I don't know, sometimes I think it's like childbirth and you just don't remember the pain and you only remember the good bits. So people who were on the side of the state, the Stasi, the army, the politicians, the academics, the so-called lawyers, massive state apparatus, have no interest whatsoever in remembering how it really was. And the other people are basically silenced by being very impoverished. You know, the ex-Stasi fought a legal case to get their full pensions recognised. Mm. So they are now much wealthier in general than the people that spoke out against them. So memory is difficult and who gets to speak is difficult. And at the moment, I feel like there's an enormous battle over who will get to write this history.
So essentially you feel that it should have been held up for public view, the way in which you say this dictatorship worked. And people have won, and as I think you say, they've had reputations they don't deserve to have.
Well, the Stasi was basically a men's club. They were men used to having a lot of power and no one could speak out against them. When the regime fell, the country was broke, but the government had about 11 billion or upwards of 11 billion equivalent in Deutschmarks, Western currency, that disappeared. All of a sudden in East Germany, you get these, you know, driving schools or taxi companies or pubs or anglers schools popping up, and they are being run by ex-apparatchiks. You know, the old joke, when you get into a cab in East Germany, you don't have to tell them where you live, they know. You know, so these funds were purloined, and some of them have probably gone into supporting the political careers of ex-Stasi in the West. So it's a very complicated and unequal 30-year history of post-war existence.
And look, finally, do you believe that with the pro-democracy protests occurring around the world, does this anniversary nevertheless represent a sort of symbol of hope of what can be achieved by popular, peaceful protest?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a wonderful and extraordinary thing that this regime ended without a shot and that so many people came onto the streets. Although I have to say, I once saw a Stasi memorandum that just said, well, there are so many of us among the demonstrators that we're giving them heart to keep demonstrating because we're swelling their numbers. It is an extraordinary and joyful and utterly fantastic occasion, but it's also a complicated thing to look at. And I feel that there is more to say and that the real story is yet to be written in the history books for German children.
Well, Anna Funder, maybe you should write it. There's a challenging thought. Thank you very much indeed for coming and joining us today.
Thank you, Geraldine.
And Anna Funder is the author of Stasiland, as well as the multi-award-winning novel All That I Am, which is a Harper publication. And she'll be speaking this evening, by the way, at the State Library of Queensland as part of their Talking Ideas series, Looking Back at Stasiland. We'll have a link to the details on our website. And if you'd like to hear more about the fall of the wall, I do recommend the RN series Why the Cold War Still Matters. Some marvellous archive on it. Part 4 will be on Sunday Extra tomorrow morning, or you can catch the whole podcast via your ABC Listen app.